This is Will Mari. Today is August 18th, 2020. I'm interviewing Dwayne Fathere, the community editor of the Daily Iberian in New Iberia, Louisiana, for the Community Journalism in Middle America, Challenges and Innovations of COVID-19 Coverage Oral History Project. Dwayne, could you go ahead and pronounce your name on tape, maybe spell it for me?
Yes, Dwayne Fathere, D-W-A-Y-N-E, last name F-A-T-H-E-R-R-E-E.
Great. We'll start out with some basic questions, and we'll come with more advanced ones. First, how long have you worked in journalism?
I have been in journalism for about 30 years now.
And how long have you worked at your current publication?
I have been here for 6 years. I did take a short break. I was a news director for a television station for a couple of years and then came back.
Great. And what is your current title?
Community editor.
All right. And what is your circulation now at the Daily Iberian?
Last I checked, we were at about 11,000.
Is that print and online as well, or is that combined?
The online, I think, is right at 12,000, but we have a lot of those are commingled with our print subscribers.
Great. And how many people work in your newsroom right now?
Reporting, editing?
All the editorial staff on there.
1, 2, 3, 4. Four.
Okay, so when did the impact of COVID on your newsroom start?
That would have been in March, as soon as the numbers started to go up and Louisiana put its shutdown order in place.
Okay, and how many reporters, or I guess not how many, how have reporters in your newsroom adjusted their routines, or how have you adjusted your routine during the pandemic as a whole?
Well, we've done a lot more virtual reporting. We've done a lot more telephone interviews. We've done a lot fewer indoor shootings. If we have to do photography, we'll try to shoot outdoors as much as possible. We have worked from home quite a bit and not in the office. During the stay-at-home period, we did not come to the building at all. I mean, I popped in once or twice just to check on things and make sure that the everything was still in one piece and hadn't caught fire. But other than that, we had always been, since we have such a small staff, fairly nimble and fairly remote already. So it was just more so.
Okay, that's great. And are there other procedures or things you did as a newsroom to keep yourself safe? I'm thinking about your photographers and your reporters.
Yes, we mask every time we go in and out. We mask in the building when we're in any of the common areas. I tend to forget the mask is on, and I'll be masked even back in my my cubicles when I'm working on things. We have sanitizer at all the doors. We have had meetings and procedures laid out where if we did have anyone test positive, we have contracts with cleaning companies that we come in and disinfect the entire office, and we have those on standby in case we need them. We've put plexiglass shields in for all of our desk workers in the lobby once we reopened that. And basically all of the things that you've seen other companies do, we've done here. We've tried to minimize the traffic into the building, minimize our contact with people in the outside, and at the same time keep up the content, which is really, at the end of the day, that's the challenge. How much precaution can you take without denigrating the content that you publish?
Yes, now that is a hard balance for sure. And I was thinking about how you personally adjusted to being a journalist during this time. I'm thinking about your home office or working around family or your hours or juggling other commitments.
Well, a lot of that has been, it's stretched my hours quite a bit. Instead of the standard daily schedule where you come in, 12 to 8 or 9 to 5 or whatever your schedule may have been, it tends to be a lot more flexible. My day starts basically as soon as I wake up. I start checking messages and checking to see if there's anything going on, see where my day might bring me. Since I'm also editor, I'm doing the budgets for the newspaper and for the website, and laying out what stories are coming in and making sure that I have bodies assigned to cover them and that they're able to get where they need to be safely. And, watching the meetings that we cover to make sure that if we are going to cover, say, a St. Martin Parish Council meeting, that they are socially distanced properly, and that they do have the same safety measures that we're taking in our office and in our homes in place at their offices. And if they don't, then we cover it virtually. A lot of them have now started doing Facebook Lives of their meeting that they did not do before. So it's possible to cover it virtually. The challenge there is that you don't have that in-person contact. You can't follow up questions. You can't observe the interaction as easily. So you lose a little bit of the color and a little bit of the depth. But we're trying to do everything that we can to maintain that depth without putting anyone on our staff or anybody in the public in danger of contamination or spreading the disease any more than it already is spreading.
Okay, that's good. Can I walk us through now what a typical day looks like for you at the newsroom or out of the newsroom?
Well, let's take today, for example. Started this morning speaking with a school board superintendent about a rumor that we heard that they were going to be changing the name on the stadium for one of the old schools that's closed now, but the stadium still carries the name of a man who research has shown was involved in the expulsion of the NAACP members and doctors from New Iberia in 1944. And we heard that they were going to take the name off of it. The school board superintendent said, no, that's not going to happen. So that was at 9 this morning. And then after that, looking at the daily content flow, we have some obituaries that are already in. And all of these things were done from home, checking emails remotely, checking voicemails remotely. Came into the into town, met with one of the council members for the Iberia Parish Council about some issues that they're taking up, and basically just doing some backgrounding and looking story development, looking for ideas that we could follow. Once in the office, have some web content that I've moved and some things that I'm working on that need to go up on the web and to be promoted online today. I'll be pushing out a curated newsletter shortly that I think the concept for today is going to be my ride in, where I saw a lot of New Iberia residents, at least 3 or 4 of them, on their way back to town after doing their shopping trip to Lafayette with all their Costco bundles sticking out of the back windows, and talking about how the initial tax base didn't suffer very much from COVID-19 and the shutdown because people shopped locally. And now that some of those restrictions have loosened, or at least the public perception has loosened, people are starting to spend their money. They're going back to the larger towns and larger areas to spend, which will cut into the local tax base. So that was up to now. So now I'm doing this interview. As soon as this is over, I will be updating the daily dump of data from the state on the number of COVID-19 cases, infections, deaths, hospitalizations, and all the other things that they cover on a daily basis on their dashboard. Then I will be going to a St. Martin Parish Council meeting at 4:30. That will be... it's their committee hearing, so it shouldn't be too long. I'll be covering that, shooting it, and then heading back to my house. It's on the way, and then doing my writing and production from there to get those ready for tomorrow's newspaper, and making sure that all of the budgets are updated during the day to make sure that all the other assignments are covered. We also have two tabloid products that we're about to publish, one on farmers in the area, because sugar farming is still a major commercial endeavor in this area, and another one on real estate. So I'll be making assignments for the farmer tab and different storylines there and getting those put out, some of them to freelancers, some of them to existing staff. Then I will look at the real estate tab, which is primarily canned material, but we'll be localizing that and adding our own photos and our own illustrations, which I'll have to make assignments to shoot those this week. And so my day started around 9 on and off, back and forth, and I'll be finished about 9 tonight. So it's about a 12-hour day. But unlike before, when you were working strictly in the office, it's not as jam-packed. I mean, there are opportunities to take a break, walk away, have some coffee, deal with personal issues and things that have to be done in between the assignments and the day-to-day management.
It's a long day, though.
Well, what I've always said about journalism is that, you know, they certainly don't pay us enough to really want to do this as a money-making enterprise. You do journalism because it's something that you want to do. One of my old journalism professors used to call it that fire in the belly to dig things up and to be involved and to be able to tell the story of the community. So the hours and the pay are not really it. A lot of times the things that I do as a journalist, I would probably do for free. You know, don't tell my boss that, but you do it because you have to, or because you desire to, not because it's going to make you a millionaire overnight.
Exactly. How has the news strategy then for your newsroom changed as a result of all this?
Well, there's some staples that have come up that we've had to staff. Like I said, the daily reporting on the progress of the disease, both through the state and locally. We have had a much higher awareness of our local hospital. We have medical center here, which is actually a parish hospital district. So it's a publicly owned hospital. And we've been very interested in both the community outreach to them as far as bringing meals and tchotchkes for the staff, and the stress that's been on them, talking with their ER doctors and with their nurses and with the ICU nurses about the difference between caring with for a COVID-19 patient and their daily grind before the pandemic. So there's a lot of different aspects of certain beats that were already in place that we've had to flesh out. There's much less live art opportunities as far as us going out and shooting a big crowd at a festival, or going out and seeing, you know, the first day of school opening, which, you know, any, you know, community newspaper, you know, that's a big deal. You have whatever reporters and freelancers you have go out and get the kids starting their first days, and the seniors doing their first day of their last year. And that doesn't happen now. We've had to cover those in different ways. Some of it's been through video of socially distanced events. Some of it's been through, personal interviews with parents and children and school officials. It's harder to get that content, though. A lot of the people who would normally speak to us are less likely to, simply because they don't want to get any repercussions if they say the wrong thing. They don't want to be the person that pulls down the story of the COVID kid that is in class with a bunch of other students that test positive. So there's some challenges there sourcing stories and finding them and getting the accurate story. When you talk to a principal, yes, everything's great. We have a plan in place and we have made allowances for every possible contingency. And then you talk to people on the street, and they say, well, my kid's class had 8 kids test positive, and the school didn't tell me about it. So then you have to go and source that and get somebody on the record. You can get the parents, and you can get the officials saying, no, that's not true. Then you have to make an editorial decision of what's accurate and what's not. So there's a a much tighter tightrope to walk in covering stories, because you don't want to provide grounds for panic, but at the same time, you don't want to miss something that is of importance to those students and their parents, because the officials don't want to admit they have a problem.
It's definitely a tough balance. And I was thinking about some of the bigger stories you've covered. You know, are they related to things like schools? What are some other examples of some of those bigger stories that you've engaged with as a staff or you have personally?
One that I did that I really enjoyed was I met with a husband and wife who had both tested positive for COVID-19. She was a assistant at a private school. And right before they did the shutdown order, they called everybody in to a small meeting room and had a big meeting. No social distancing, no masking. And she says that's where she caught COVID-19. She had a mild case, however. She felt bad, but she just thought it was, you know, a bug. She didn't think it was COVID because she was able to breathe. She didn't have a lot of the hallmarks that we think of. Her husband, however, he was taking care of her. And one day he just walked in and he said he went down like he got hit by a ton of bricks. He was getting his coffee and he went and laid down on the couch and said, "Oh, I just don't feel good." And the woman's daughter came in and said, "Dad's not good. There's something wrong." So they brought him immediately to the emergency room and they said, "Yeah, he has COVID." And he spent 3 weeks in the hospital, 11 days of that was intubated on a ventilator. And came back. He lost 55 pounds during his stay, which, you know, over a 3 week period, that's a big weight loss. This is not some wilting flower. I mean, this guy spent 30 years in the oil fields. I mean, he was, active, very strong man, and this thing just wiped him out. So I went and visited them in their home and interviewed them, and they told me their story. And it was this was when you still had a lot of people saying, "Oh, this isn't real," and the hoax stories were going out there. And after that, anybody who said that, I immediately told them, "You're wrong. You need to go visit somebody who's been through this." I mean, even the woman who did not have a severe case, it wiped her out, and she. She wasn't ventilated or put in the hospital, but it was enough that both of them had been home before he came down with it. So, and then the other side of that was meeting with the doctor who is handling the ICU in New Iberia. He had been he was doing his internship in the 90s in New York City when the AIDS epidemic was at its peak. So he had been in an ICU where you had people coming in with a fatal disease that no one really understood, and had mass casualty, basically situations where you had to prioritize and triage your treatment and triage the availability of equipment. And he's been Dr. Kitakuli has been a big help here because he was able to look at the pandemic as it started up and say, "Look, this is what you need to do. This is how you set up a negative pressure room. This is how you set up your procedures and your standards for operating in a pandemic environment. These are the things you have to do. This is the PPE that you need. This is the way that you go from patient to patient, from room to room." And speaking with him and one of the other doctors, I think really gave the community some insight into how it was being dealt with here. For small hospitals, community hospitals, rural hospitals, the perception is that they don't have the same standards and the same service that you'll see at, an Ochsner Hospital in New Orleans, or a LSU Medical Center, where you have a large campus and a large teaching hospital. But sometimes, if you're lucky, you will have that one individual who can pull it all together and give you the standard of care that you would have even in a larger facility, just by knowing what to do and what not to do. So those two stories I really enjoyed.
Those are great examples. You know, and thank you for sharing those with me and with the project. Kind of going on to some other kind of bigger questions in terms of the field after this next one. How has your paper experienced any sort of financial difficulty, or have you had to do any layoffs or furloughs or things to reduce production to save money? Has that been something you've had to do at the New Iberian?
Well, one of the things we did, we did a salary cut when we went to the at home status, and that lasted approximately a month because we weren't sure where we were going. We didn't know how it was going to affect the bottom line. We didn't know, whether we were going to have ads or have financial support coming in. What we discovered after looking at the numbers is that people still bought the paper. We still had advertising coming in for our tabloids, and we made our budgets. So we were able to push all the salaries back up where they were. We did consolidate some staff positions on the sales side. We pulled back, I think we eliminated three sales positions. And there were one that it was already vacant. There were two that we put on furlough, and then eventually those positions went away. And we moved those. We have a side product that we produce called Acadiana Lifestyle, and it's basically a monthly tab publication. And what we've done is spread the sales effort across the sales staffs of the newspaper and Acadiana Lifestyle. So we've been able to maintain the presence and maintain the work, the level of sales, without having those extra positions in. The goal, I assume, in the long run is going to be to build back up to where we can bring some of those salespeople back in and take the load off of the others. We've also, some of the day-to-day grind work that normally would not have been done by the reporters, like obituaries, birth notices, cops reports, all of the things that you would usually use a news clerk for. We're still in the position, in the search for a new clerk to replace the one who left. But in the meantime, we're doubling up, and, 2 days out of the week, each one of the reporters takes on covering those needs and making sure that they're produced and ready to go for the print editions. We're printing 3 days a week now. So that gives us a little bit of leeway in making sure that all that production is done in time for it to hit the paper.
That makes sense. That sounds like a series of.
So we've been cautious. And we've done the things that we thought, if we were in a worst case scenario, would have to be done, and we did them early. And luckily, it kept us from bottoming out. Like I said, we have made our budget. Our our reach within the audience has not dropped at all, and our advertisers are coming back as they reopen. We still have some challenges there because, obviously restaurants, bars, much more limited, and the bars aren't advertising at all. They're basically still shut down, especially after the Fifth Circuit decision yesterday. So we have less of an advertising base to attack, but we're making headway, and we're making sure that when we do finally ramp up and get back, if things get back to where they were, we can bring staff back in and make that happen.
Yeah.
So how has it changed journalism on our side?
Yeah, how has it changed the field, do you think?
Well, I think that in some ways we're facing the same challenges that every other industry is facing. We let everybody out of the veal fattening pens. Now how do we get them back in?
Mm.
A lot of people, they love not working in the office. They love not ever having to go to the building, just filing their reports from wherever, being foreign correspondents, basically. And that's is not a bad thing. I think that, I mean, personally, whenever I've managed a newsroom, I always loved going out in the parking lot and seeing it empty because that means somebody was out working on stuff. Mm-hmm. I think that we're having to reevaluate, the model that we've used for, a century of, a bunch of reporters sitting around click, clack, click, 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 clicking on keyboards in a room. And instead just base the work on the content. And as long as we're getting the multimedia and as long as we're getting the text and as long as we're getting the images and we're getting it in a timely fashion, whether or not you punch the clock and show up and actually hang out at the water cooler, that's not as necessary. Now, the challenge there is that we've also noticed that there's a drop in communication, depending on the person. Some people don't over-communicate, so you have to be sure to reach out and make sure that there's still contact and that you're still aware of where stories are going and what developments have occurred, whereas before we just, run into each other in a hallway or yell over a cubicle wall. So that luxury is gone. We still do our budget meetings. We still, some of those are virtual, some of those are in person. But I think that there's a lot more, we've shown that you can have more flexibility in how you do that and in putting together a product without the constraints of a physical office.
What other innovations have you or your newspaper undergone that you think have been beneficial or something else? What are other things to be done that's along the same line as working at home?
Well, we're pushing a lot more video content. We're a lot more involved in updating our website. And these are things that needed to happen anyway. I think that the pandemic merely gave us the lever to make those things happen and kind of push in that direction. Like I said, we went to 3 days earlier this year, so we were already having to post more to our website. We were already having to do more online work and more online reporting. And that, with the pandemic in place, we had no choice. I mean, that's the only way we could do it. And it's also, I think that it's made us more responsive. I think that we've learned that you don't have to write a 25-inch takeout mm-hmm. on an event. You can do it in pieces. You can use breaking news to get the first story out there. You can come back and follow up with your in-depth. I've always been a proponent of whatever goes into the paper. You don't really have a lot of first day stories in a newspaper. It should be second day follows because you've already broken it online. You've already done the who, what, when, and where. So, mm-hmm. You've got those four W's out there already, and you can take the nut graph from that online story and stick it into your why story and have a solid, professionally tailored piece. I think that the pandemic allowed other people to reach that conclusion, especially people who were resistant to, the online side, thinking it was not as valid.
Cool.
So, a lot of the younger journalists, they still, I think they come into the profession with that trench coat and fedora mentality that, I'm going to run around and that print is, that's the king. That's the one with all the depth. That's the one that's going to withstand the test of time and that you're going to find it, 50 years from now in the bottom of a box that was locked away in an attic. And that, it's a time capsule. It's never going to change. I think that the people who came into it with that mindset really denigrated the online side and said, this is not as permanent. This is something that changes. It doesn't have the permanence. And I think that they're learning that online work has its own validity and that in some cases, especially when you're breaking news and you're working on a story where you have an opportunity to be the first person at each paragraph to bring something new to your readership, they're learning to embrace that and they're learning to enjoy that and they're learning to find the value in that rather than just in the final honed product that goes into the dead trees and that we print on those 3 days a week. Now, it doesn't denigrate those pieces. It just means that there's a different way of doing it and that there's a value that's now being attached to that that I don't think was there before.
Mm.
I could be wrong. I mean, that's just my perspective. But I do see, more credence being given to the online output from newspapers as opposed to your online-only outlets and to your television outlets. That we still carry that cachet of trust when we go online. And as long as we maintain that, I think that we have, no matter what the naysayers will say, we still have a valid place in the media tripod.
Kind of along those lines, what changes have you noticed with your reader base, if any, during the pandemic?
They're a lot more likely to reach out to us online. We get a lot of social media messaging. We get a lot of even phone calls. I mean, people will call more often. We get more interaction when we're out on the street. They're like, oh, newspaper's here. Okay. I think that they're actually thankful that we're there, which is weird because, the last 3 years, having the profession a little soiled from the attacks of being called, the enemies of the people and fake news and everything else. I think that under the reporting, especially in this market on the COVID-19 pandemic, has been balanced and fair and rooted in fact. We haven't gone out on any limbs talking about conspiracy theories. We haven't taken anything that is not based in evidence and published that. We've always maintained the standards and the credibility that we strive to have in the print product, even when we're online. And I think that that has really benefited us. People know that, they see the around the clock posting and things coming up, 10, 11 at night, 6 in the morning. They see that we're not just sitting around for 3 days and then publishing a newspaper. They know that the reporting is an ongoing process and they're able to see that visibly and understand that just because they didn't get a paper that morning doesn't mean that we're not out doing our jobs and that we're not performing those watchdog functions and that we're not reporting on the community and we're not finding the stories of, this weekend we did a story, an interview with a 16-year-old who's going to space camp. She flew out Sunday. So we sat down with her and talked about, her future dreams and what she wanted to do. So there's not just the hard news that we're keeping up with. We're still trying to keep those fingers, deep into the community pie and be able to, tell what people are up to and what they're doing and to relay that story to everyone else in the community.
No, that's great. And so important, that kind of brings me to my next question or next few questions here. But, how has the pandemic influenced you personally on a personal level?
Personally, like I said, it's my schedule is completely, wackadoodle. There is no schedule. I have some hard deadlines I have to meet for the print product, but other than that, or an appointment or a meeting, there is nothing that is a given. Yesterday when we were supposed to have our first interview, I had a press conference for a racketeering charge that was the arrest warrants were issued in, and so I had to pop up and disappear, and I didn't even come back to New Iberia. I was off in the hinterlands for the rest of the day. And that's not a lot different from the pre-pandemic, but it's a lot more likely to occur than in pre-pandemic times. When you have something that's going on, there's especially a live event where you're going to have an opportunity to enhance the story with, in-person interviews and with art and with all the other bells and whistles, you jump on that. That's your first thing of the day. And if you have something that's a little bit more research based, maybe a little bit more of a writer project, you hold off on that so that you can make the time to get any kind of human interaction into the newspaper and into the website. It's also, you know, it's changed my approach to people. We're in a deep red state, and a lot of the people that we deal with, especially politicians, up until the last month or so, were wandering around with no masking. They were still walking up, and it was almost like a purity test. They'd walk up and try to shake your hand, try to make content like, "Hey, how you doing?" And you'd have to kind of back away and say, "Nah, we're not doing that this week. Yeah, not feeling it today." One of our parish council members was very much of that mindset until he came down with COVID-19. He showed up for his first meeting after recovering, and he was wearing a mask, and he was 6 feet away from everybody, and he did not reach out his hand to shake anyone's hand at all. So I've been trying to get him to do a story about his experience, and he won't go on the record about what he went through. But his demeanor and his outlook changed 180 degrees. So, you know, initially it was difficult to maintain those guidelines and those standards because you had so many people who did not want to, for whatever reason, abide by them. But that's becoming easier as time goes on and as they either catch the disease themselves or know people who have either passed or caught it and recovered. So it's less of a fake news story and more of, I need to do this or else I'm going to come down with it.
Yeah, that's an important change for sure, you know, with people's perceptions. Thinking about kind of perceptions and what happens after this is all over eventually, what changes do you think will you keep at your paper after the pandemic, and or what things do you think are not going to continue or are going to stop doing after this is over?
Well, I think that we're finding ways to do interviews in person, just not inside of small buildings, small rooms. So I really want us to get back to that, to getting that human contact as much as we can have. I think that that brings depth to your stories when you can actually look the person in the eye and know what they're saying. I want to keep the flexibility of schedule. I want to keep the distributed work model where you can file from anywhere. I want to keep the emphasis and the focus on multimedia and on the web traffic. I want to keep the focus on breaking stories piecemeal throughout the day. And some of these are things that should have happened already, but I want to make sure that we don't lose the leverage that we gained through this experience. You know, as a business, I want to see us bring our sales staff back in. I want to see when the community ramps back up, I want to see those efforts start up again. I want to see us continue to do in-depth work. And I think that part of being out of the building has allowed for more of that. I think that sometimes when you're not in a, in an office, that you think differently and that you see more opportunities and more options. You know, I may be wrong, but I've noticed that for myself, that I'm more likely to say, hey, maybe we can go try this. And I think that that experimental aspect of it, that hey, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that, maybe we can we can go a little bit deeper into how this doctor got here and what kind of past they have, or we can talk a little bit more about this this person's experience, not necessarily with COVID but with other issues as well. I think that we've developed a better sense for that. And I would like to make sure that that stays intact. And there's also the matter of getting things done, no matter what the adversity may be. You know, we didn't miss a beat. You know, we didn't miss in stories. We didn't miss any publications. We have managed to keep our feelers out and through various social media contacts, through our story development leads and people that we reach out to. I think that we've managed to keep a very strong relationship with the community. And I think that that shows, and I think that's been appreciated, and I would like to not squander that wealth that we picked up from that.
That's important. You know, and that kind of leads me to my penultimate question here, but how has the pandemic influenced your views of journalism and society, its role, kind of broadly speaking?
Oh, it showed me how essential it is. If we don't do it, then you end up with, you know, the demon sperm doctor taking up a lot of the bandwidth. You have to be real. You have to say what's true. If things are getting worse and the pandemic is becoming more entrenched, you have to be able to tell people that. If the curve is flattening and the steps that are being taken apparently are making a difference, you have to be able to tell people that. And you have to have them believe you when you say it. You have to make sure that your credibility is there, and that when, you know, you publish something, that it is true and that you're not missing the boat and that you're not buying the wrong sourcing. I think that it's gone a long way in the outlets that have maintained their standards and maintained their reliability towards fighting back against the fake news push. Like I said, you know, using my my poor councilman as an example again, you know, he was one of saying, oh, y'all are spending all this time on it. And now that he's seen more of it and everything that he experienced was borne out in our stories prior to that, you know, he's realized that it wasn't fake news. It was something that was really happening. And it was something that affected his life in a very, very meaningful way. So I think that we've gained some major points towards restoring the credibility, especially on the print side, because I haven't seen any of the newspapers go out on the far left or the far right side of it. I think that for the most part, the industry has stayed with what's real, and that's going to go light years towards enhancing its credibility overall.
And so that leads me to my final question here. What would you want journalists 100 years from now who might be covering a new pandemic to know about this time or about your experience here in South Louisiana?
That you have to understand where you're getting your stories from. You have to understand, and this is no different than covering a political scandal or a lawsuit or anything else. You have to understand who you're talking to and have a very, very strong feeling for where their reality lies, and understand any bias that may be included in the story you're being told. And that's one of the things I think newspapers do well. A lot of times I've watched coverage and I'll see where national or international outlets will pick up on one little bright, shiny aspect of a story and go with it. You know, I mean, right now we're in the middle of talking about voting by mail. And, you know, the fact that Donald Trump and Melania Trump have filed for their ballots to vote by mail, that's great, but that's a footnote to a story. That is not what you use to drive your coverage. The deeper story is the, you know, why is this happening? You know, in their case, it's because they're in Washington, D.C. It has nothing to do with the pandemic. They would vote by mail anyway. But what's happening on the ground with people who are trying to vote by mail? Where are the people who can't vote in person or who are afraid to vote in person? I know people that haven't left their homes in 3 months, that they have had family members or delivery services provide all of their contact with the outside world, at least in person, that have taken this very, very seriously. Some of them are older. Some of them have immunological issues that make them a lot more acutely aware. But, you know, you have to understand where people are coming from when you speak with them and be able to use what newspapers have always done, which is the filter and the judgment of what makes it to that front page, in order to make yourself relevant to your market and to make yourself accurate and reliable to your market. And if you don't do that, you know, you're dead in the water. The first time that you go off on a limb and go down a conspiracy rabbit hole, whether intentional or not, you're going to lose that credibility. And that's what's going to kill you, not the disease.
Well, well said. Thank you, Dwayne. That's a great way to end. I appreciate your insights and your time.
Oh, great. Is there anything else, or does that basically wrap up everything you needed to know? Or
I think that's it for now.